This is the Home Tech Podcast Show number 29, recorded on June 9th, 2011. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live on Ustream from the Average Guy Studios here in sunny Bellevue, Nebraska. I should say thunderstormy Bellevue, Nebraska, this evening, and posted each week on theaverageguy.tv. If you'd like, you can contact the show, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Follow the show on Twitter. Just use my Twitter account. That's at Jay Collison. Or you can find us on Facebook just by searching The Average Guy Podcast. Tonight, I'm joined by the guys that join me every week and a brand new guest this evening. So let me start with Christian, because I usually introduce Andrew first. So Christian Johnson. Christian is the guy behind BIOS Mods and all things speed at theaverageguy.tv. Christian, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm doing great, guys. Had a great week. Got through the final exams, so I'm back to tech projects and going to start rolling out some new stuff, so excited to be back on the A-train.
Yep. Sweet, and you've got, I don't know if you want to announce the site here on the podcast, but you've been working on a site of your own, right? The one that has your name associated with that, is that something live that you want people to know about, or are you just...
Yeah, we can start. I'm working on right now I'm working in the process of writing a... really long program, actually. It's going to be kind of something that has the same amount of code probably Facebook will take. So it's going to take me a couple of years to finish. So right now it's like alpha, beta, kind of super particle one, and no one really knows about it. But
whoa,
I call particle. It, yeah, super particle. So it's like when it's less than milestone. But it's called ChristianNet, and what it's designed to do is it's a digital life archive. So basically my entire life is stored in an encrypted SQL database, and then whenever I want to add an event, so say it be just a text event or just dragging, dropping pictures and video, I'll just have an application on my computer where I'll type an event for a day, it'll timestamp it, any pictures or photos associated with it, great, it'll be there. So I can just do that and hit send, and there's no coding involved. And then that gets stored in the database, and that's always encrypted and always available. And then based on your level of access to ChristianNet, you can see what's going on in the digital life archive, whether you're a friend or a family or whether you're public, you'll be able to see different things that are a part of my entire archive. So one of the things that kind of inspired it was in the next couple years, I'm going to start having to have resumes ready for job interviews. So one of the big focal points for this site for me is that potential job interviews or anyone in general will be able to have access to my digital resume, which would be just like any old resume you would hand someone on a hard copy, except say they see programming for XYZ amount of years at such and such a place doing such and such a thing. If they want to find out more about that that wouldn't normally fit in the standard resume format, the database will automatically walk through all other instances and references to programming and those particular things. So it's going to be a really cool way to kind of tie everything together that I've been doing into something that I can let people see bits and pieces based on who they are and what relationship we have. So that's kind of it's going to be the same intensity amount of code that Facebook requires, but it has a different approach and a different purpose. So
it's exciting. Going to be just for you, or will this be something that you can repurpose so other people could kind of create their own page on as well?
Yeah, eventually I'll probably repurpose it and make it something that's, you know, a public available API. But at this point, I'm just coding for myself right now because I'm not ready to kind of move something of that big a scale. Something that needs so much testing done. So soon.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of cool. It sounds like it's going to take you a while. And if folks wanted to see what the beginning of something that like that looks like, where would they go?
They can go to christian-johnson.net. Mm-hmm. And right now there's really not that much up. You'll see a little bit of strange colors and a couple of black and white text entries, but really a lot of what's going on is in the back end of SQL. So I will be posting status updates to anyone who's on my Facebook and possibly start on Twitter. So keep tuned because that will be one of the projects coming up this summer. And also a quick shout out to all those at the Home Server Show John, who we worked on today, another server-related problem, and a friend from Argentina listening in, so we have some international publicity going on. So
excellent. Yeah, we got 9 in chat. That's, I think, the most we've had. So congratulations, guys. Good show. It must be you, Andrew, who's brought all the audience in. Andrew Morris is our international guy from Melbourne, Australia, and is also the genius behind HP. So how are you doing this evening, Andrew?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Jim. Been a long week in the trenches and starting to wind down for the weekend.
Yeah, this week I was home doing a little vacation of my own, and of course I was watching HP Discover 2011, which was the conference that HP put on, and so I pinged Andrew, "Hey, are you watching this thing?" And so we watched a little bit of it together, and it was really good, Andrew. I'm really.
It was a little slow. That was a good corporate presentation.
I know. Didn't you like that? It was an excellent corporate presentation, that which we'll talk a little bit about when we get to the HP touchpad. So special guest tonight, a friend of Christian's and a guy we've gotten to know who's hung out in the show chat from time to time over the last couple weeks. His name is Jason. Jason, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right.
Good. That's good to have you. You're out in Florida, right? You're in sunny Florida. Is it like a million degrees down there already?
It hasn't been too bad this summer. The past few summers, it's just been like unbelievably hot, and then you add the humidity, and it's just like, you know, you look at the weather guy on TV, and you're just like, really, dude? It must be nice in that air-conditioned studio, you know, naked from the waist down.
Yeah. He's got shorts on. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
So now you work with Christian at BiosMods. Kind of what kind of things do you do there at BiosMods?
I'm in charge of the slick modding. People that, you know, have bought a legitimate copy of Windows, and they don't want to have to go through that stupid activation phone call because, you know, when you register Windows so many times or whatever, your hardware changes or whatever, you got to call that phone number. That gets around it. So basically, you're doing exactly what the OEMs like HP, Dell, Compaq, all them do with a computer that they sell. It's all built into the CD that they sell. I also do like, what else
AMI.
Do I do?
AMI modding section.
Yeah, I do the AMI mods. We unlock hidden features in the BIOS that, you know, the manufacturers and stuff like that have locked out because, you know, they basically don't want to provide tech support in case somebody screws up.
Is that the way it works? I mean, so really BIOS, there's stuff in the BIOS that works that's just not available to you because they don't want to enable
it? It's hidden.
Okay. So what HP and all these companies are doing is because they have to build a computer that's, you know, preset so it's very easy to diagnose, they limit the amount of features in the BIOS so that, you know, if they're getting these calls at their 1-800 number, they don't have to take into consideration, well, what if they have something weird set up in their BIOS? Because the BIOS is very easy to misconfigure, and then you have all sorts of crazy problems that are hard to diagnose. So if you are a technical person and you're sitting with an OEM box and you may want to overclock it or do something more with it, maybe change the type speed on the keyboard, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff. And normally, in many cases, you'll have an OEM BIOS that's available, you know, off HP, these other sites, and they have pre-coded all of these options in, and they've basically just changed segments of the code so that they don't show up when you boot up the computer. Part of that process is all we're doing is changing those function checks so that they show up as regular options. But they're all pre-coded, and it's easy to reorganize the structure and menu tree on the BIOS. So that's part of what we're doing.
What's the most common feature that's maybe not available or something you guys are enabling for folks in the BIOS? What do people ask for?
Yeah. Usually overclock settings.
Yeah, okay. Overclocking is huge. There's a lot of people who buy these OEM computers that, you know, they're i7 quad cores and all this, but they can't really do any overclocking. So a lot of memory timing settings, overall CPU specs. And some other common stuff too, surprisingly, is the cool and quiet. A lot of OEM computers have had issues where they don't enable AMD cool and quiet by default, and then the CPU has all sorts of problems going to that lower power setting. And so that's part of what we're doing as well.
So chances are if I have a OEM manufactured PC, a Dell or a HP or something like that, that BIOS has probably got some features available in it that I'm not able to take advantage of because the manufacturers locked that out. Is that
exactly
a pretty true statement?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, interesting. So if folks want to know more about what they could do. So if I just go to your site, which it's bios-mods.com, right? .com. And do I just put the model number for my PC in, or what do I need to have?
Right. All you'd have to do is go to the forums and register a user account, and you'll be able to post your computer specs, what's going on, anything specific you want us to look at. And then one of the team members will pick up the BIOS and kind of tell you if there's anything hidden and what you want enabled. So you'll be able to, you can also search through the site database to see if there's a motherboard or computer model already that has already been unlocked and able to be pre-downloaded. There's what we call a confirmed section with BIOSes that have already been tested and proven to work with other users, and kind of a feedback area for that. And then there'll be another area for, I'm testing this BIOS out, or I'm not sure if this is going to work, or can you help me out with unlocking this? So,
cool. Jason, how long have you been working with BIOS mods?
almost a year, I think.
Okay.
Wouldn't you say, Christian?
Yeah, about a year, year and
very
a half
cool.
now.
Very cool. Well, it's something we don't talk a lot about on the show, but I'm always intrigued by it. I know my kids have all bought boards from Newegg or whatever, and they go in there and hack those things or mod, they overclock, they do whatever, right? They do that pretty frequently. I'm a kind of set it and forget it kind of guy. I don't mess around with the BIOS very much. So it's just one of those things I'm kind of content to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So worth looking into. BIOS-mods.com. All right, guys, let's get started. One of the news articles that came across my screen this week, actually a little prompt from our old friend Brian Burgess. Brian's writing over at Information Week, and he wrote the Cloud Music Smackdown, which is 10 facts on Apple versus the rivals. Now, Brian kind of came at this from an Apple perspective. Amazon was really the first to offer cloud music storage. They fired a shot across the music storage bow about 4 or 5 weeks ago. When they offered a 5 free gig of storage for your music, plus anything that you buy doesn't count towards your storage. And if you purchase an album, you can get up to 20 gig of storage. Google seemed to respond pretty quickly at that point with a 20,000 song limit, so not an actual size, but you could upload up to 20,000 tracks to your account, but no store. And then recently, I guess that was earlier this week, Apple announced the iCloud. Which, could they just have more products with an I in front of them? I don't know. Maybe they could.
It was an original name, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you know. But one of the things, his first statement about cloud-based music, and you guys can confirm or deny this fact. He says the hype around cloud music services is crazy right now. Do you think cloud-based music storage is overhyped, guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah, Christian, expand on that a little bit for me. Why do you think it's overhyped?
I just think it's something where your music library is something that you keep locally, and between your iPod and syncing to iTunes or Zune, you're not really there. What's the real practical purpose of offloading that music elsewhere?
There's an advantage to me in that, say, if I'm your average consumer and I've got maybe 10 gig worth of music. Now, I don't know. Let's do a quick survey here. Andrew, do you know how much music that you have in gigs?
About 100 gig.
Okay, so quite a bit. Jason, how much do you have that you own?
I probably have somewhere around like maybe 10 or 15 gigs.
Okay, fairly manageable size. Christian, I know you guys have a ton. Your dad talked about that last night.
Yeah, we're at about 200 gigabytes.
Yeah, so 200 gigs, so about twice as much as Andrew in that. But certainly from my standpoint, I'm a 30 gig guy. And I could probably, I did some ripping with a Ripcast back in the day and pulled some music down off internet radio. So maybe half that music is stuff I recorded. But let's just say I whittle that down to 10 or 15 gig. There is an attraction to just upload it to Amazon or upload it to Google. Just let them store it, right? I mean, why would I? I'm a home server guy, and I'm on the home server show each week, and we talk about storage. But if I've got 10 or 15 gig worth of music, isn't it easier for me just to let Amazon or Google or maybe both. I mean, talk about redundancy. Upload it to Amazon once, upload it to Google once, and then depending on where I'm at, I could access it from either one of those places. I would fit right within the current boundaries of that service and not have to pay anything. Why would I not want to do that?
Yeah, true. I don't know. I sort of tend to think, look, out here we have the bandwidth challenge, right. which is no surprise. I know I keep banging on about it, but you know the theory with our mobile network is we get 8. So for me to stream from the cloud, I'd be constantly stuttering. I mean, you and I've tried to even have a Skype conversation.
Right.
And it just doesn't work without our mobile network. I think your mobile network's a lot better, depending on your carrier, as long as you're not with AT&T.
Right.
AT&T
is good in some spots. I mean, it gets a bad rap on the coasts, but here in the Midwest, AT&T is fairly strong.
Yeah. But out here, I just don't think our network's up to it.
Okay.
And we don't have the local storage. So, you know, private cloud using something like Subsonic, I think, is not a bad idea.
Okay.
If you can have it geographically close to you, that's probably a better option.
Jason, what's your methodology of music storage right now? How are you managing your music files?
I just use a Windows Home server. We stream everything, thanks to Christian and enlightening me to the glory of Windows Home Server.
There you go.
I've just upgraded to 2011, as did Christian or whatever. You know, we do it on that. I store like my game backups and stuff like that on there. I mean, I do everything. I don't really see how they're, why they got this whole cloud thing. It's almost like they're trying to gravitate it towards like some kind of social networking, you know, like, oh, well, you know, you've got this song in your library, you know, these other people have the same song in their library. Why don't you be friends? You know, like Twitterizing it or Facebookizing it.
Go ahead, Christian.
That's actually true, because I've seen on Facebook recently these people obnoxious to see my feed filled with, oh, guess what I'm listening to now, or, oh, hey, guess what I'm listening to now. So, I mean, even if you're paying for, even if you want to offload all of this music and have it available somewhere else on cloud services, even to put it on a web host like IX Web Hosting is going to be cheaper and quicker to access. And then you could put to, you know, if you had the technical willpower to, you could get one of these easy to set up media managers for the web where you just kind of drag and drop the files into your web browser and then you're ready to go. But it's interesting because, like I said with Jason and what I've kind of been saying with the entire cloud, is that the cloud limits you because you're surrendering, you're not surrendering, but you really in essence are sending and surrendering your data to an outside source that you don't have control over the hardware or where it's being stored or who has access and how it's being stored. It's something that's on someone else's hardware. So that's the first assumption you make. The second assumption you make is that every month you're going to have to look at a bill for something you may use more one month or may not use at all the next couple of months. So why not have something at your own place where you're putting together a box like a home server or even your desktop and putting something like Subsonic or Air Media or any of these applications that just let you, you know, install the software and then you can access it through your IP address or whatever it be. But we're slowly taking each part of our media and digital experience and handing it over to the cloud. We saw it first with the documents, then with the file sharing, then with the remote desktop, now the video. This is just the next component. Why not add music? We can charge another $10 a month. We can control another aspect of their digital lives, and we'll get less support calls of people who can't understand these higher-end complex products like Windows Home Server because we're not making the support guides and the community necessary that enables the home user to think of it like a toaster and make music come out of their server, you know? So it's a question of whether or not we want to pay to have someone else do it and own our media, or whether we want companies and products to come out with not only innovative things, but some sort of resource where people can be educated, because I think a lot of the problem is people just don't know where to start. And, you know, even if it's something simple like setting up music and making it available when you're on the road, you know, a lot of people don't know how to go about that in a non-technical manner. And I think that's something that we have lost as a result of having the cloud being available.
Well, but it doesn't it grow out of this iPod era when everybody, you know, you download it to your PC and then you sync it up to your iPod and then, you know, okay, what if you take an iPod to another PC and that doesn't sync right and everybody's syncing? I mean, isn't it just easier? I've used the Amazon service now and it syncs up with my Android device just beautifully. And if I listen to it, it caches it the first time, so I've got it available on my phone after I've listened to it one time. You know, to me, it seems a lot easier, and it's just a change in thinking to keep my production or all everything I own that I want to use in the cloud, and then maybe I download that to my home server to be stored, because I'm not going to trust Amazon with everything, right? I'm not going to – that's not going to be the source of record for me. I'm going to want to go ahead and, you know, leave it there to use it. And if Amazon ever goes under or goes down, I still have that available on my home server to do. So I think it's still – and I know we've talked about this over the last couple of weeks. I still think it's fairly – this cloud music, because everybody is into music. I mean, you know, some of these other things, video, okay. I mean, that's touching a big part of the population. But music is huge, and the music industry is held on the tightest to the reins on that music. And so as this stuff gets out and goes cloud-based – I do find it very interesting. I've been known to say before that I think eventually we'll end up 100% streaming and you'll just never own music.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
I'll make you a proposal. So let's have everyone who's listening to the podcast do a little bit of an experiment. So part of what I've been talking about and what my dad's been doing is how we manage our media library. So I'll let you guys assess our cloud solution for yourselves, which for us doesn't inhibit our own privacy, and we manage the music. And whether you're listening on your phone in the car over a 3G connection or you're streaming a Blu-ray video through our server, you'll have 100% throughput to over 25,000 songs and movies. So I just included the link in the Ustream. If you head over to maplegrovepartners.subsonic.org, that will take you to our demo Subsonic server. And it'll be interesting to see what listeners find more convenient. But again, to have on-demand access to your music like that in a format that doesn't cost money and is seamless quality over any internet speed, I'd be interested to hear your feedback. So I dropped the link in the Ustream, and hopefully we'll get a couple people to listen in and see how they like it.
Maybe they'll take it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm almost wondering if, like, you know, the RIAA and the MPAA aren't all behind, like, all these cloud things or whatever as a way of tracking down people that aren't legitimately buying their music or videos or whatever. Because, I mean, like, you know, they can tag that stuff. We've all bought music or, you know, streamed a video and downloaded it to the hard drive. And then, you know, happen one day we just go to look at the file properties or something and there's a tag in there saying that, you know, it was bought from blah, 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 or, you know, whatever, you know. So, you know, it's only a matter of time until they start putting, like, something like a tracking cookie into these music and video things to tell who's buying what and where, you know.
Yeah, I think it's already in there, to be honest with you. But
Andrew, I wouldn't be surprised.
Andrew, with your limited bandwidth or at least caps that you have, is your preferred methodology to download it to a device? And just listen to it that way and keep it on devices rather than trying to stream it all over the internet?
If we're going to be mobile, yes. If we're going to be in the home, then our bandwidth is getting better. So at the moment, I've got an 8 megabit downstream connection. So if I'm streaming off the Maple Grove subsonic site, it's perfectly stable and I can stream via our TV or the Xbox Media Center or directly via a PC, so it works really well for me. That does, but on the mobile platform, it's somewhat lacking just due to bandwidth.
Okay. Well, this is certainly a new topic, and we've been talking about it for a while. But the reality of it is, they've really only been out less than 2 months. And Brian's conclusion at the end is that we're very early in the technology, and be careful not to get married to any one of these, because I think they'll probably change pretty significantly over the next year or two. We'll post the link to Brian's article out in the show notes, so you can go out and take a full peek at that. He's got 9 other points, but certainly I'm very interested. Ironically, I don't listen to a lot of music, but I'm very intrigued. My kids do. And I'm very intrigued by kind of this cloud music idea, as well as documents and pictures and, you know, some of those other things. This new offering from Apple will include documents and pictures and some of those other things that you can upload at least 5 gig for free. So check that out. Check out Brian's article. He does a nice job. He's a great writer, so he does a nice job of filling that article out.
I love the way he signs this one off. You want to date and not marry for now.
Yeah. And I would say maybe even just look at from across the table.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be very cautious. I think there's going to be a lot of changes. And I think the music industry is even out, to determine who's going to get sued first and how this is going to work and if it's going to stand up in court and are they going to be allowed to store the music. Or combine it. I know people said Google just wants to index that music and, you know, pull it together. And so I think it's interesting. It's interesting. So I think we got some good stuff coming up. Andrew, you wanted to talk a little bit about some stuff. Why don't you go ahead and cover your stuff?
Yeah, a couple of things that I've seen around the traps this week that caught my eye. One of them in the vein of my useless bits of software that I've seen in my travels is a product called Nemo Docs, which calendarizes the document usage on your PC.
Oh.
So for argument's sake, if you're someone who generates a lot of documents, and this may be helpful to some of the guys who are generating content, if they're creating Word documents.
Right.
Yeah. So what it does, it indexes your machine and provides you a calendar view of what document you've worked on and when you've worked on it. So it integrates with the Windows desktop search, and it indexes, you know, things like Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Adobe documents, various images and video files, and sort of gives you a different view and helps you organize your documents better. And I looked at it. I mean, I don't generate a lot of document content, but I go through phases where I work on a heck of a lot of photographs. So for me to be able to track what photograph I'm working on or editing at any given time or have worked on is kind of cool to be able to go back and look at it in that calendar view.
And that's right now that's in a free beta form?
Yeah, it is. It's free at the moment.
I assume they're going to charge for it at some point, probably.
I don't know. Maybe? I think it's one of those things. It's got a fair. I think it's got a bit of competition with the likes of Google Desktop and the other search platforms. You know, the Yahoo Desktop and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see where they go. It's from what I've seen, does it a bit better than some of the other similar products that I've seen out there.
Yeah. I could see for someone who's creating a lot of docs. Based on the day, it might be easy to go back and find them. Then, I created that last Tuesday, right?
I mean, if you were a legal secretary or something like that, and you were just constantly, you know, churning through dictation,
right?
Something like this would be phenomenal because, you know, your boss could come out and say, "Hey, you translated something Monday 3 weeks ago," and you just pull it up and go, "Bang, there it is."
You know, I see they've got a notification in the example. They got a Dropbox. Notification. I assume it's also going to index anything you drop into Dropbox since that's still local on your PC.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the beauties of Dropbox too, isn't it? It is a local folder as well as in the cloud.
Right. Yeah. So, very cool.
Yeah, I thought it looked pretty nifty, and I'm playing with it at the moment. I've got it on my home PC. I haven't thrown it on the work one yet, but for tracking, because I'm editing our wedding photographs a couple of years after the wedding now, and to be able to go back and, you know, say mentally to myself, I edited this photo last week, but to be able to go back and pin the actual photo that I want to look at is becoming really useful because I can't do that with Lightroom and I can't do it with Photoshop. So to be able to go into another tool and do it is pretty good.
And is it date last edited? Is that what it's looking at?
Yeah, that's why it's working.
Okay.
Yeah, that's nice.
Very cool. All right. Good stuff. What else you got?
Yeah, the other thing that that came up, and this came out of the HP launch from the other night, mm-hmm. and it's also hit the media, is the touchpad is finally going to be made available for the market on July the 1st.
Yeah.
So,
I like it.
The WebOS iPad, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
So pricing's in line with the Apple product. The only ones that have been announced so far are the Wi-Fi and they're looking at being $500 for the 16 gig and $600 for the 32 gig. And orders are being taken through, not sure which retail outlets, but as of the 19th of June.
Well, Andrew, one of the interesting things I saw in that video was this. So if you have a Palm Pre, and I think this was – or not, it's hard for me not to say that.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, if you have a Pre, I think – I don't know if it's an HP Pre or I forget what they're calling it now. But yeah. And you've got a tablet, you can touch the phone to the tablet, and when you touch them, whatever's website is on the phone will automatically be transferred to the tablet, and then you can move on from there. That was kind of an interesting – now, I don't know if there's a special spot in like only one spot and it only worked in the demo because it really wasn't a functionality that worked. You know how that goes. And then you actually try to do it and it doesn't work. But that was pretty cool. I do like that tablet. Christian, you're holding off for this Asus tablet, right? Is that come? Has that happened yet? Is it out there?
The one with the removable keyboard and the whole flip stuff is just kind of coming out and getting prime time. It's not really available yet, but they have a couple models and that are getting ready to go to market that are really cool. And I mean, even the ones where they're talking a couple years down the road now at Asus is having your, you know, whether it be an Evo or a general phone, you plug your phone into the dock and then the dock converts to a tablet, and it's just neat stuff. But the one I'm looking at right now has the removable keyboard, and you just snap it on and twist it around, and you know, you can look at it upside down if you want, but it's just becoming really versatile. So,
and what's the price point on that the one on your that you're looking for?
Not too sure on the prices, but I can't imagine they're going to be over roughly $500-$600. Actually, I think I'm just getting from the all-knowing source of Gary Johnson that it's $500 right now. So,
he must be listening out there, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, Gary. Is 500? Are we gonna bump off this 500 and make its way down to the 299 or 250 or 279?
Not till it's been around a while.
Yeah. I mean, how long?
That came out weren't that low. Right. So I mean,
2 years.
Yeah, I'd say probably 2 years to get some of that lower end, strange stuff going on.
Okay.
Like Acer was the first company I can remember that went down to that 299 range after the EEPCs had come out. So it'll be more of the same thing. But,
okay. Yeah. I like to see the competition coming out though. I mean, it's nice. I'm starting to see more mainstream Android tablets come out, not these crazy ones from China that, you know, you never heard of before. That we're actually getting some mainstream Android tablets. I'd love to see this HP touchpad offering. Jason, if you had a choice of a tablet at this point, based on what you know on the iOS, the Android, and this HP touchpad, or any other tablet OS, what would you go with if money wasn't an option right now?
Oh, I would go with the Asus. I mean, you know, there's a lot of them out there. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. But I mean, like, I prefer to get my hardware from, you know, a reputable vendor and stuff like that. Like Christian mentioned, you know, the Acers, oh yeah, you know, they can drop them down to a lower price point. Like, you know, 290 has had horrible, horrible stories about Acers, you know. I mean, like, they almost continuously fail, like, right after the warranty period.
Yeah. Andrew, what about you? Which touchpad are you buying if you're not worried about money?
Ooh, it's a hard one. I mean, I'm becoming almost disillusioned with Android, but on the other hand, I still like it.
Okay.
I mean, you and I've had the discussion. I like the concept of the ecosystem with the Apple product, but not having seen what WebOS is going to bring to the tablet format, I'd be interested to see what it's going to do. HTC have just released some Honeycomb Android tablets, so they've just released the HTC Flyer. So that'll be something interesting to look at. And then you've got the Playbook from RIM. So it's going to be interesting to see what it's going to be interesting to see what's out and about.
If HP writes in enterprise security to the touchpad and sells it to its enterprise customers, does that take over? Does that become the de facto touchpad for enterprise?
It does for us.
Yeah. Well. Obviously, at that point,
choices there, Andrew.
he gets no choices in his enterprise. But you know what I'm saying? For the rest of the world, I'm not asking to predict the future, but does?
I think it could. I know one of the things that I've read on the net about the new version of WebOS is it needs to be Exchange compliant, because one of the challenges that iOS has on the Apple device is that you have trouble enforcing Exchange security policies down to the device. So yeah. Android does it very well.
So
if your Exchange administrator says you must have a 8-digit PIN code to unlock your phone after 15 minutes, the Android will enforce it. iPhone doesn't do it.
Right.
I believe the new version of WebOS does it. So I think that means that they're also serious about targeting the corporate market with that product line.
Yeah. Well, and I'd like to see HP go after the medical industry and really create some sweet web apps for folks in hospitals. I mean, that's where these target the best. And Lux would have something to say. He would probably say that the iPad already has the corner on that market already, but they're not, the iPad's still not enterprise ready, in my opinion. I mean, it can live in someone's consumer space. It's just as unready for the enterprise as the iPhone is. And and so to your point, I've witnessed the Android readiness for the enterprise, and I like it. I mean, it works well in an enterprise environment with the securities. I think HP has the advantage in the sense that they have such a huge enterprise footprint already in organizations that are out there. So, you know, they're the number one PC manufacturer, especially in the enterprise and the business. Yeah, Christian, go ahead.
Yeah, and also another industry too. Teachers are getting really, really, really hands-on friendly with tablets now.
Right.
Even my school has all the teachers are issued an HP tablet. They're all using, you know, and it's interesting too, because a lot of the teachers have the tablet, but they won't use the tablet functionality. They don't really have a purpose for using the touch screen as much as putting something up on a projector. But yeah, they're all HP tablets
running Windows 7.
Yeah, Windows 7 Ultimate.
And maybe that's because that doesn't have such an intuitive touch screen. I mean, it does, but it's not intuitive for people to switch over that and use it, right? I mean, they may not even know it's there.
Yeah, I think they know it's there, but again, when you're working up on a projector and you're trying to show slides, I mean, how practical is it to be using the touchscreen? Because the way it's set up is there's an HP dock, so they actually just no matter what room they're giving a lecture in, they just drop the laptop into that HP dock, and then it goes to the projector and the sound system. So, you know, if you're docked like that, it's not like you're going to be walking around carrying it in a tablet format. So it's not like you're going to be prodding at the touch screen while it's in the dock, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, between teaching industry and even like you were saying, the medical industry, I mean, if you go to almost any pediatrics office now, you'll see all the nurses walking around with their tablet and, you know, writing things in. So it's got its industries, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm anxious for the touchpad to come to a Best Buy near me.
Yeah.
So I can go.
Best Buy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You're not going to like my story then, Jim.
Uh-oh. Well, we'll talk about that here shortly. Andrew, anything else on that?
Yeah, I think what I'm waiting to see with the tablet, and especially in the context of the classroom, I think it's probably more relevant, is if you can tie in a tablet, be it running iOS, WebOS, Windows, whatever operating system it happens to be, if you can tie that in with a smart whiteboard and you're the teacher and you can do the Microsoft Surface type flick like they do on Hawaii 5.0 or NCIS or whatever it happens to be, so you can have all your notes prepared, you can be walking through your lesson plan, and as you get to that particular item on a PowerPoint deck or whatever, you just do the flick and it's up on your smart whiteboard, and then you flip your next page out. I reckon that is where this technology is going to absolutely shine. And I don't know who's going to bring it to market first in a consumer grade or educational grade product.
Yeah, but it'll have to be cheap, right? I mean, for the education system, it can't cost a lot because we know schools don't have a lot of money.
Well, the education, I don't know. I mean, your government school system probably doesn't, but your private school system does have the money to pay for that technology. Sure. So I think it'll be interesting to see if that comes to the market at a reasonable price. So, you know, say you spend a couple of grand on a smart whiteboard, and then you've got your reasonably cheap tablet, your $400-$500 tablet. I think if something like that can be made come to reality, that is going to kill the educational sector.
Yeah, you may be right. You may be right.
That's just my opinion.
Yeah. No, I think those, you know, I think those tablets are coming. They're coming fast and furious, and it won't be long before we have those, like, I think, like cell phones, right? You're carrying, maybe not instead of, but you've got one close by that you use, and you just, you know, again, or maybe the cell phone fits right into it, or it interacts with it, or some. I'd love to see that, you know, in this offering with HP, I'd love to see that just automatically pair with the phone. And then I don't, you know, maybe there's a proprietary wire or a receiver in there that you know, you have to have both of them to make it work. But then the tablet picks up on the 3G service for the phone, and, you know, if you just got it in your pocket or, you know, whatever nearby, it just works.
There's no reason why that can't work now, is there, really?
No.
I mean, you look at the what's that application called for the iPhone, Bump? Mm-hmm. You know, where you can get an Android copy of it as well. You want to send a contact or a picture, you just grab your two phones, Bluetooth on, knock them together, and the accelerometer says, hey, I'm going to transfer something.
Right, yeah.
So that works pretty well.
Yeah, I do think the tablet has got some life coming up here. You know, I don't think, I mean, certainly the iPad is off in the front runner. But I do think there's some second and third place folks that'll have some significant say in the next couple of years from a tablet perspective. So I think that's coming up. All right. Anything else, Andrew, before we hit?
Nah, that's all from me.
All right. Christian's Corner. You got it, Christian. Go.
Okay. Welcome to Christian's Corner. Kicking off with the speed tip of the week. This is actually kind of more of a customization tweak featured by Jason. Worked out a new context menu off of his little mini blog. It has a lot of common commands from that same context menu where we added copy to and move to from one of the last tweaks. So this enables your standard shutdown, cancel shutdown, CMD, lock, log off, restart. So it's got some pretty cool features, and I'm going to put the link up. Andrew will have access to it to get in the show notes. So that's another way to add more quick links to right to the context menu, which, if you think about it, the context menu is a pretty popular way to start launching commands, especially if you're navigating halfway in between Windows Explorer and you're at your My Documents. You can just right-click and do whatever instead of having to go back to the Start menu. So it's the neat little customization tweak for the week. And moving on to the deal of the week, Newegg is selling a Samsung Blu-ray that was originally out at $55 this week. It was one of their deals. It's back up at $65, but was originally $75, so we're still getting $10 with free shipping. And it's a full Blu-ray 12x speed Blu-ray ROM with the DVD and the CD and all that stuff. And it comes with SATA cables and manuals. And if you look at the specs, it shows you all the different speeds for whatever medium you're putting into the Blu-ray, and it came with the Cyber Media Suite and Windows Media Center integration. So for $65, if you want to go Blu-ray enabled on your PC and have the software built right in and get some free SATA cables and whatnot, this was a pretty sweet deal. So
yeah, and why wouldn't you just go Blu-ray at this point for that price?
Especially because, you know?
I mean, you can get a DVD for $20, but
you know,
I guess if you're never going to use a Blu-ray, maybe that's the reason why, but why wouldn't you?
But I mean, even so, just to get the hardware and have the Cyber Media Suite come with it so you can play off media centers is nice to have. That was one of the appealing features of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the deal of the week. And for the content section of tonight, I'm just, again, continuing to be befuddled and amazed by the happenings over at Facebook. I was on this week, and it told me this week, finally, we had discussed a couple episodes back how they started rolling out email for everyone and how you could get a Facebook email and stuff. And this week it had asked me, for the first time today, it was like, do you want to activate your new email features? And I kind of didn't dawn on me that they would be putting those messages in after it had already rolled out quite a while ago. So I enabled it. Not really sure if I'm going to get any use out of it. And it also, as soon as I enabled that, it was like, well, while you're at it, do you want to enable text features so that anyone who's a friend on your Facebook can just send a text message to your phone right from Facebook? So I was like, sure, why not? So I turned that on. And then in the middle of all this, there's the hot debate on the internet right now over Facebook recognition software and the privacy violations with having facial recognition. And now what they're talking about is having auto face recognition where Facebook suggests how you tag your photos. So instead of you uploading photos, or you see someone in a photo who isn't identified and you hit the tag button and you drag the little square around their face and then everyone knows who it is, and then the person who gets tagged is notified about it. Now they're just using this recognition software where they recognize the person in the photo when you upload it, and it's already pre-tagged, which some people are kind of creeped out by. Some people are going all copyright infringement. And
what do you think, Christian? Does that creep you out?
I don't know. If it was something where it was like, part of the reason why people were so angst about it was that it was a feature that Facebook said they were going to put in like a beta environment, and if people wanted to sign up and try it, they could. And what they did was they just secretly enabled it, and no press knew about it. There was no heads up from the company, and it just started happening. And I think that ticked off a lot of people because they didn't know it was coming. But I'd say, in some ways, it's a cool technology, and it's something that no other company is doing on that scale. So the technology aspect is amazing, but the practicality is kind of debatable, because why would you, if you're gonna tag someone, you're gonna tag certain people, and you have reasons for tagging people, and there may be some photos you don't want to have tagged and archived. So it's just because of the way the tagging is set up, a lot of what the problem people have is a lot of Facebook users are confused by the privacy panel in their account. They don't really understand how to use it, how to save their options, and how to be smart. So for this feature to be enabled by default is kind of a yellow red light warning for me. So in some ways, while the technology is cool and it can be put to good use, I don't really think it's practical for the way they rolled it out. Now,
yeah, so you would want them to reverse that privacy and just say, let me opt into it if that's what I choose.
Right, yeah. Right. So, opting in would be the first thing. And the second thing that kind of came to mind when I was thinking about this was, if you get locked out of your Facebook account because it thinks there's some security issue, one of the ways you can get back in your account is to identify people, where it'll display pictures from your account and it makes you say, who is this, who is this, so that you can get back in. And maybe it would be interesting, instead of having that, here's a good way to put the facial recognition to use. If you're on a laptop or a computer with a web camera and you want to revalidate that it's you who's using your account, put that facial recognition software to work and turn on the webcam and see if the face who's staring at the screen is the person who owns the account. So, these are features they could just turn on and have people opt into, but to be blindly adding these things and not updating the privacy policy is a huge warning light. But yeah, I thought that would be a cool idea for them to kind of consider, because it's doable.
How cool would facial recognition login be, though? If you type that into OpenID or any one of those single sign-on services, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. I think
except, though, right? So
got to have a camera with you.
Well, okay, but facial recognition built that's built into like Microsoft Photo Gallery, right? I don't know if you've used that. Same kind of idea. It regularly mistakes my son for me. Right,
because we have very
similar facial characteristics, and so I still think there needs to be a second form of identification other than just facial recognition for now, until it gets better, until absolutely 100% of the time get me instead of somebody else. What if I put a picture up there of me?
What I was about to just say. I'm like, dude, like I would mess with so many people on Facebook. Like I would just do a Google. Thanks to Google, you'd be able to get into anybody's Facebook account.
Yeah.
If they like institute what Christian said, I would just go to Google Images. I would search somebody and I would just print out their picture on the printer and I'd hold it up in front of the webcam and get into their account.
Now, a dual camera that like on Kinect could beat that, right? Because it's looking for two-dimensional. It would be looking for a three-dimensional image, right? Yeah. So you couldn't do it with a Kinect. But that being said, I'm just not so sure we're as 100% accurate as we need to be with
I think you got a valid point that the accuracy isn't there yet, but I think Facebook is now becoming one of the leading facial recognition software programs. But
do you think they had that in mind when they started, that eventually that would go that?
I don't think so. Okay. I think this is my blast into the future that they should pay me a couple million to help them incorporate.
Listen, you're already richer than all of us, Christian. So.
Yeah, well, you should, Christian. You really should. And fix PSN while you're at it.
Yeah, right. So, and another interesting thing, when you're talking about holding up the photo and the whole three-dimensional thing, the new programs that are out for Windows 7 login credentials for the facial recognition for these Windows 7 laptops makes you you start by just looking at the webcam, but then the screen says, okay, turn your head to the left, turn it to the right, you know, tilt it upside down and rotate 279 degrees. But it makes you kind of move your head so that it's getting the 3D image of your head. So rather than having that flat 2D image.
Your audio is out, Jim.
And goodbye, Jim's audio.
No, I muted again. Christian, almost like a mugshot, right? So it says, okay, face forward, now turn to the side, right? Because it wants to see both the front and side shot of your face.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I
Makes
think
sense.
That's a wrap.
That'd be good.
All Christian. Right. That is Christian's Corner. Jason, you got a few things you want to share with us. Why don't you start with the first one?
All right. Well, I'll save the bad one that you won't like for last, Jim, from your earlier comment.
All right.
Okay, my first one is school district hit with new Mac spying lawsuit. Apparently in a suburban Philadelphia high school, the school had given out Mac laptops to the students. And apparently they were taking pictures of the students while they were using these laptops at home and stuff like that. And one of the kids was really embarrassed because, you know, he opted once the lawsuit was put in place. There was actually two lawsuits. I guess the first one was settled. And then this other kid, you know, found out about it and he was like, wait, you know. And, you know, he sued. So he's suing for like $175,000. And then like there's a $425,000 in court costs. And, you know, when they started getting the evidence together and stuff like that, you know, the plaintiff opted to view the recovered images and was shocked and humiliated and severely emotionally distressed at what he saw. I mean, not really a good use of taxpayer dollars, in my opinion, you know.
Was the intent, though, to see if the laptops were being used by the student? I mean, what's the intent?
I guess, you know, they don't really touch on that.
Okay.
I don't really know what their purpose was behind it. I imagine it was something along that lines, but apparently it just wasn't being used for that. You know, like, you know, I can understand accidentally getting a picture because the kid left the laptop on and he was changing in his room or something like that. You know what I mean? But somebody's got to be monitoring that. You know what I mean? Like these pictures were taken in such a way that like, they weren't appropriate, obviously.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It wasn't just like a quick screen dump. Okay, he's working in Word on his science homework. You know, okay, we're done. You know, and then they log out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Christian?
Okay, my thing is...
You can just jump in, Christian. You don't have to raise your hand.
I know. Well, I like the moving finger. He's okay. Like my little pen pal. Anyway, in Pennsylvania, there was a very similar lawsuit for a different school. Some of the things that come to mind is if you look on some of these tech forums where there's like the school IT administrator who's kind of stuck on doing stuff, they all get together on these websites and talk about ways to secure down their hardware. And I just laugh every time I read it. One of the guys who wrote on one of these forums wrote that the school wanted to ensure that the laptops the students were taking home were being used that in the same way they would be used if it was a computer at school. So the acceptable computer use policy that's being instituted at the school would be carried over to the laptop or whatever at home. So obviously, bizarre and wacko reason. I mean, what's the real purpose for activating a webcam to take a picture? If you want to see what's going on the computer, have it take a snapshot of the desktop. Why do we need to be taking snapshots of the people using the system? If the snapshot of the screen capture lines up, then fine. But in the first place, I would feel alienated to have to use one of those laptops just knowing that someone's creeping around on the laptop trying to find a reason to, you know, if you're making a Skype call to your relative out in Chicago, do you want your IT administrator creeping in on your Skype call? I mean, that's I wouldn't want to opt in for that at all. But I mean, a lot of the kids aren't aware that those things are possible.
Well, in the school's defense, right, they said that the activated cameras on the MacBooks were used to track laptops that had been lost and stolen. Right, so it's that's how they were kind of tracking those down. If the laptops came up missing, is they could then take a snapshot of whoever was using it. Now, that seems to be much harder to track down, just by seeing who's on the other end. I mean that, but in their defense, that was their. But it also says, according to the lawsuit, they use the laptop to make more than 8,000 photographs and screenshots between September 2008 and March 2009.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind crazy. Of the absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? Yep. I mean, somebody had the power. They probably thought it was cute. They probably thought they'd never get caught. I saw a Facebook post today from a buddy of mine, and he said, hey, note to famous people, don't do anything because you'll always get caught, right?
Yeah.
and you know, in light of this scandal with Mr. Anthony Weiner or Congressman Anthony Weiner, you know, you will always get caught. Just don't do it. If you're going to be in the public limelight, don't do it. You're going to get caught eventually. So, the report commissioned by the district uncovered more than 30,000 photographs and another 27,000 screenshots taken when the tracking and security software was activated by the district IT personnel. It's a lot.
I think it's an interesting concept though, because if you lose a corporate laptop, they have the ability to track a corporate machine via serial number, or any machine via serial number, as long as it connects to the internet.
Right,
and that's one thing that people don't realize. We've had Dell hardware in the past when I worked for EDS when we were a Dell shop, and we had Dell hardware that was stolen, and then you know a couple of weeks later it'd appear on the internet, and the police would go and do an IP reverse lookup and track it back to wherever the house was. And they would go in and repossess the hardware. So, this is just a different. To me, this is just a different method of tracking.
Yeah.
Of tracking.
I don't think
hardware.
It's very efficient, though, Andrew. I mean, a picture.
Oh no.
Yeah. So now you got to track that down and find that person. I mean, I think it was a good idea that was poorly implemented. GPS in there would be a better right.
Oh, true. Or RFID or something. But I mean. Tracking via serial number, that was also more common back when you were still paying, you know, $7,000 or $8,000 for a laptop, and that was a lot of money.
Right.
You know, whereas now you're paying what, $2,500-$3,000 for a laptop, and
maybe,
you know,
without
wanting to be flippant, that's retail. Yeah.
Right. Right.
But you know, without wanting to be flippant, it's not a lot of money, is it?
Well,
really?
You know, so lesson learned. I mean, I've always been. I forget what the movie was, but there was a movie a couple years back where. The guy was constantly hacking into webcams of people. And so throughout the whole movie, it just seemed like with a couple keystrokes, he could get into anybody's webcam. And after that, I was always kind of creeped out. I thought, can they really do that? Well, I don't know if they can do that at the personal level here when I'm blocking it. But obviously, if you're going to get that kind of equipment given to you, you got to be maybe a little suspicious about what's on what's on. And I think if it was a PC, if it was a Windows PC, I think the first thing I'd do is delete the. Well, maybe they put something in it so you can't, right? But I'm going to blow the OS away.
Type over the webcam.
Yeah, I don't know. So, Jason, what else? Oh, go ahead, Andrew.
With that one with the schools, were they machines that had been like? And I get the whole appropriate use thing because you know we all of us corporate citizens have to adhere to it as well. But was the context that they were machines that had been provided by the school and it was part of?
Yeah, they were provided by the school.
So it's part of the education contract with that student
the
machine in a certain way.
There were 30,000 photographs taken and 27,000 screenshots taken.
Yeah,
That he says they liked what they saw in the photographs more than what they found in the screenshots.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess the screenshots would probably matter too.
And frankly, I think you know the girls' pictures would probably have been a lot more. Look at than you know this boy named you know Blake.
Yeah,
you know, it's going to look at the girls, not the boys.
it does. I mean, I think it does beg the point that you need to be careful. You know, with that kind of stuff that's provided, both corporate and you know
educational.
That you know a lot of schools are moving towards these like laptop giveaways for the students and.
Right.
Just be smart about what you get from school district.
Yeah.
So
which is strange because I think that's more of a public school thing because in our network, I mean, everyone has the resources to use a desktop at school. I mean, they don't need to be taking laptops home. You know, if they have a paper to write, they stay after school and write the paper and get it done and go home. I mean,
it's become real popular though, Christian, for schools to give out laptops for folks to use for the 4 years they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, another thing is like, you know, they've got these aspects, you know, where, you know, they check to make sure teachers aren't like, you know, sexual predators and stuff like that, you know. But like, are they doing that with these IT people that are, you know, supposedly servicing these laptops and making sure they're being used for what they are? Are they doing background checks on these people?
You make a good point. That is a very good point.
Because, I mean, that's probably a private company, like a small company that they have a contract with, you know, not like a large company, but something the school board could, you know, afford.
Mm.
Boy, that is just an open
can of worms.
Really, that is a Pandora's box for problems of giving. You know, Jason, I'm kind of glad you mentioned this because I hadn't really thought all the way through this. I have no idea what you're doing, Christian. I'm watching you on your webcam. That's what I'm doing. I hadn't really thought through this issue all the way with a school issued, you know, piece of hardware and all the implications that comes with it, including keystroke. Or key loggers and screen capture as well as webcam capture that you know, sends it back to a central server. So that's kind of interesting. Oh, all right. Jason, we're running out of time. What else you got?
I've got our Best Buy. Apparently Best Buy is planning to get small as sales fall. Apparently they haven't been selling as many like full computer systems and you know, digital cameras and stuff like that. Apparently, they're going to start focusing more on, like, the small tablets and the netbooks and, you know, mainly the cell phones. You know, they're talking about opening only, like, mobile-only Best Buys where they just, you know, sell cell phone and cell phone accessories and smartphones and stuff like that.
What do you think if they opened a kiosk at the mall? You know, you got those crappy little phone kiosks. What if a company like Best Buy had a Best Buy branded kiosk at the mall?
Malls are expensive as it is. You know what they charge for the kiosk is ridiculous.
Oh,
like,
true.
You know, Best Buy is already ridiculously expensive for stuff.
Right.
Try going in there and buying a crossover cable.
Oh yeah.
You, you can't even find a small one. You know, usually the only thing I've ever needed is, you know, maybe like 12-inch, you know, crossover cable. But no, they've got like 20, 40 feet crossover cable with gold-plated contacts and stuff. And I could order it online for a lot cheaper. But I don't want to wait for it because I need it now. You know what I mean? And
right.
So they weigh with it. I mean, that's a lot of stuff that they've got that's set up like that at Best Buy. You know, not to mention, you know, all their crazy ads where, you know, they've tried to get over on the customer where, you know, they have a mock ad on the internet and they're like, you know, the customer comes in without the sales flyer and they're like, well, let me check what it says on the flyer. And they pull up the internet version of the flyer. And they're like, no, sir, it's this. You must have misread it. So they were ripping people off by $150, whatever, you know. I mean, I just see maybe Best Buy going, you know, the way of the buffalo, you know what I mean? If this is what's going on and stuff like that. I mean, Circuit City already went down the tubes, I mean, with this recession and stuff. I mean,
yeah,
we might not have a Best Buy much longer. And I missed seeing Circuit City go. They were a good place to go.
Well, the reason Best Buy is so expensive is because they're one of the few left, and they know they can get that pricing, you know, on cables. That's where they make their money. I mean, they don't make money on Windows PCs. They make money on the cables associated with them, just like the TVs. So it's, you know, I did see an interesting article just the other day. Walmart's getting smaller, right? So they're opening these Walmart Express stores, which are basically like a convenience store but it's all Walmart, you know, branded stuff. I'm assuming at a discounted or maybe not quite as discounted as much as the big store, but, you know, cheaper than a 7-Eleven or a you know, one of those kind of convenience stores. Why couldn't Best Buy move into a smaller, you know, move into some smaller stores and make it a Radio Shack competitor, right? The Shack isn't doing that well either, to be honest. But it you know, to me, it would be nice from time to time, especially for phone accessories. They're small. They don't take up a bunch of room. If I didn't have to drive all the way out, in my case, drive all the way out to my local Best Buy to pick it up. If I could get one of those here and that's maybe closer to me because it's smaller, that might be more attractive to me than driving all the way out to the big box store. I don't know. It's an interesting concept. We'll have to see. Jason, did they mention where they're going to pilot this, pilot maybe the first stores at? Oh, Jason, you did the dreaded turn your mute on as well.
Jason did the Jim Collison.
Yeah, you're mute. There you go.
Jim. no, it didn't really mention it. I think it's just a plan that they released to the, you know, to their investors and stuff. And it, you know, it obviously made a headline or whatever, you know, because, you know, people probably buy stock in Best Buy. I wouldn't. I mean, I'd probably, you know, invest money in Radio Shack because those guys are always on the computers inside of Best or inside of Radio Shack checking their corporate shares through Radio Shack that they've got or whatever, you know, and checking how many cell phones they sold because they are really big on their cell phones.
Yeah, yeah. I've been surprised that Radio Shack has made it. And I should just say the Shack because I think that's their official that's their official name now. But I've been surprised those stores have made it. I'll be honest, that's if you're looking for parts, you know, little components, little tiny things, if you're trying to find – you know, and I don't know.
A couple of diodes or something.
Yeah, something real odd. Even odd cables. You know, if I'm going from a quarter inch to an eighth inch cable, you can get that at Radio Shack. They'll have it. You know,
yeah.
They've got
some of the ones in Florida they don't carry a whole lot of that anymore. I mean,
really?
You know, like their resistors, they might carry only from like 100K ohm to like 500K ohm. They don't have a whole lot of selection for diodes or anything like that.
Well,
I've been
and
going
not so
to
much
mount-
those. I'm thinking about the small cables, the small parts. I'm trying to think.
The cables still. I go to Mouser.com for all my small components and stuff like that. I mean, they have everything. You know, you need a fan, and then you got a good description. And I mean, like I know Newegg does a great job with, you know, people, you know, putting their user reviews on like, you know, fans for the inside of a case or, you know, 4-pin Molex connector cable, you know, with ferrite shielding on it or something like that. I mean, Mouser.com's got everything. You can even get replacement chips for stuff. Like, I've found bias chips for motherboards on there, you know. And, you know, Chris got the EEPROM programmer and stuff like that, I could just sit there and order a bunch of them and, you know, send them to him, and he can just already have them ready for whatever computer or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, well, certainly online is a different story, but I know from time to time I've needed various cables for this various sound setups that I've done, and especially if you need an adapter, you know, those things are easy to find online, but try and find one. You know, it's Saturday at 2, I needed it at 4.
Yeah, exactly.
For an event, right? And I forgot to pick it up, or I forgot to order it online, or whatever. I could always go by the shack, and they would have it every single time. I mean, they just have those odd... they might have those odd adapters or cables. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to watch and see if the smaller Best Buy competes with Radio Shack from that perspective. All right, Jason, one more. What do you got?
All right, I've got a quick tip. This shouldn't take long at all.
All right.
It is – let me grab it here so we can put it in the thing here. Because my
Please
window
wait
acts.
While we calculate your amazing tip for the day, brought to you by the guys at Average Guy.
Brought to you by Biosmonts.
Okay, this is wet cell phone rescue. I'm sure we've all put our phone someplace where we were in a hurry and we didn't quite think about it before we did it. Our hands were full. We're trying to do 20 million things at once.
You're getting up off the toilet.
Yeah, and then the dreaded splash happens. You know, you're getting out of the car and it lands in a muddy puddle, or like, you know, you had it sitting on the edge of the counter, like you said, Jim, and, you know, you went to grab it, but something else got knocked over that you weren't looking at, and it knocked the phone into the toilet or the sink or whatever. So this is a quick tip. Basically, first thing you should do, pull the battery out. Don't turn it back on to try and see if it's going to start up.
Right.
Pull the battery out. Pull your memory stick out. You know, if you've got, like, a little card in there to store stuff, pull that out. Pull out your SIM card, of course. Obviously, do that right after the battery, because you're usually right under the battery anyway. And then what you do is, not everybody's got like a big box of silica laying around their house that they've been opening up the little thingies from the pill bottle and stuff and dumping it into the box for in case this happens. So what I'm suggesting here is you get a big Tupperware container, doesn't matter if it's brown or white, and get yourself some uncooked rice. And you put your phone, and this can work for more than just phones. I mean, you could do this with a PSP. It hasn't had real good luck with iPods or iPhones, of course, because, you know, the battery's sealed inside the unit, so you're pretty much SOL there. It could work, depending on how bad it got, but the post I found said that they soaked these phones in water for 60 seconds. And, I mean, usually... people react a lot quicker than 60 seconds when they drop their phone in a toilet. So, you know, they went the extra mile here and made sure it was submerged, you know.
Unless, right,
but the rice will dry out. It'll absorb any moisture left in the phone. And another tip is you can use, like, the compressed air to try and blow out any additional water in there, or even a vacuum that'll pull it out a little bit.
Well, that's a good idea. I never thought of that, using a canister vac.
Yeah, but don't use the hairdryer. A lot of people have tried microwaves. Ooh. They've tried putting the phone in the oven. This can warp the circuit board. It can damage the screen. It can also damage the membranes if it's a rubber contact membrane for the keys underneath. Not to mention, like, hairdryers get really hot, and people are like, oh, I'll hold it right on there so it'll get dry really, really quick. And it winds up melting the solder on there. And some of those chips are surface-mounted ICs. And they will, like, if that solder hasn't cooled all the way when you go to pick that thing up, that chip's going to slide inside that circuit board, and it is not going to be on there anymore.
Just slide right off. Just
oh, yeah. Like right like a tab of butter on a pancake, you know? It's going to go...
That's a great analogy. Yeah. You know, one of the things you didn't mention is if you dropped it in salt water...
salt water, they actually recommend that if it's salt water, that you get some fresh water and submerge it in the fresh water, as it will dilute the salt and wash it out, and just kind of give it a shake. Pull it out, shake it off some more. you know, and then put it in the box.
It's going to be tough for people to think you've already submerged this, you know, say it drops in your saltwater fish tank, or you're at the beach and you drop it in the ocean. That it's going to be hard for people to take that phone and take it up to the, you know, take it up to the bathrooms or whatever, the drinking fountain.
Yeah.
And wash it and get it even more wet. But but you got to get that salt out of there. You got to kind of submerge it, you know, put it under that water again and make sure you get the salt out of there. You know, one of the things in there, of course, every cell phone has an indicator whether it's been wet or not on the inside.
I have a solution for this as
really?
Well.
All right, go ahead.
Yes, that little tab, you can cover that. You got to look for it. It's usually got like little red print on it, you know, and it's like a white sticker usually. And then it gives that pink or reddish color when it gets wet. I've seen some that turn blue. I've seen some that turn purple. You know, it's like the old school void stickers on the back of the PlayStation 2s. You know, if you ripped it off, only part of the sticker came off. So when you ripped it off, it said void in little letters. The foil print would be left, and it would say void. You know, but what you do is you can get like a label maker or some Scotch tape or any kind of sticker that will fit over that, and you just cover it with that. So in the event that this happens, you know, if it still doesn't work, you can say, hey, I dropped it, you know, because, you know, they don't care if you dropped it. They just care if you submerged it in the water, because they want to probably be able to scrap some of those parts out of there and put it in a refurbished unit, you know. So just cover that little, and sometimes they do put them in places that are really hard to cover.
Right.
Some of them are on the batteries, but you can usually still cover that as well.
All right, good tip for the average guy who drops his phone, his cell phone or whatever into the, you know, I was at work the other day. This has been a couple weeks ago, and in the morning this gal came in and she was carrying a bag of rice. You know, a Ziploc bag of rice, and she was just carrying it in, and I'm like, "Hey, what you got in the rice?" Your phone? She's like, yep. And so she was bringing her phone in, hoping it would dry out over the day, and then she could turn it back on.
The other one that's good is those desiccating crystals. You know, when you buy like a pair of new running shoes, and they got the little sachet of gel in the desiccating gel.
Mm-hmm.
That works. Rice does a better job though, because you can actually immerse the phone in it and get it all in the bits.
But, you can get enough of that in there to really pull it out. That's really the easiest way, you know, white or brown rice dried just sucks the moisture out of anything.
And just donate it upwards.
I wonder how much money I could make off eBay if I just bought that silica stuff, or, you know, in large quantities and just sell it to people. Hey, have you screwed your phone up? Here, buy this, you know.
Yeah.
$10 for a pound.
Or a baggie of rice in a Ziploc bag and sell it.
We won't tell them what it is, you know.
Special organic. You can. It's biodegradable.
Yeah, super absorbent rice for cell phones.
That's awesome. Well, guys, good show. I appreciate you guys taking the time to come out this evening to chat with us. Jason, great having you on the show for the first time, and nice work. Good job having you. Thanks for coming out.
Well, I'm glad I did well.
Yeah, you did great. I appreciate it. It's good to have some representation from Florida. Andrew, thanks for taking out your lunch hour to be with us.
Good, Jim.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And Christian, excited about the summer of technology.
It's going to be a great one.
I think we got some good technology going on. You and I are going to try and get together and do some upgrades to the averageguy.tv, and maybe by the fall we'll have something new for the site. You never know. Maybe we'll have a christian-johnson.net plugin for the averageguy.tv.
Oh, boy.
Anyways, I want to remind folks, if they want to contact the show, send us an email, give us a comment or some suggestions on what they'd like to cover, have us cover on the show, send us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. You can find us on Facebook. We post the announcements of when the shows go live out on Facebook. That's kind of the easiest way. If you're not getting it in an RSS feed and you want to follow it on Facebook, you can do that. Just go over to Facebook in the search, type in the Average Guy Network, as well as you can follow me on Twitter @JayCollison, and we will post both Andrew and Christian's Twitter account out there on theaverageguy.tv. Andrew, thanks for those show notes. I want to highlight those again. You do a bang-up job on making sure the show notes, they're the best in the industry. Nobody has better show notes than we do, so I appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, Andrew, don't forget to, you know, put in the hamster-powered computer that Christian submitted.
Yeah, I might make a post out of that. Andrew, did you mute yourself?
Andrew.
Yeah, I did.
Well, let's see. I think maybe Christian is the only one who hasn't muted himself tonight. So
what can I say? I know how to use the microphone. It's, you know, those microphones. They're
well, I have
ones.
To click it off in Skype because I got a pretty basic headset, so it doesn't have the neat little switch or button.
Actually, Skype's the better way to do it. It's quieter that way. So that's the way to get it done. Andrew, thanks for those show notes, by the way.
Oh, good night.
Good work. I appreciate you doing that. We'll be back next Thursday night, 7 o'clock. Although, guys, I'm really thinking about moving this to 7:30. It's really hard for me to get all the way back in here by 7 and get things going. But 7 and 7:30 Central Time, 8:30 on the East Coast, 5:30 on the West Coast. And what time are we there on the East Coast of Australia, Andrew?
It's currently midday.
So sometime around, 11:30, 10:30, do we get started?
Yeah, between 10:30 and midday, depending when we start.
So, and we've had quite a few folks listen from Australia. So if you're out there and you want to listen during the middle of the day, you can listen to us live. We'll get your feedback, and we do the show each week live on Ustream. So, guys, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.
Night, guys.
Night.